Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
All right, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. Today we have Micah Kubik. He is the director of the Kansas chapter of the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union. And we are going to be talking about voting rights, and in particular a case that involved, that was in the courts, involving Chris Kobach. And we'll talk about it a little bit wider as well. And we also have Spencer Graves, who is co-hosting this with me tonight and who will ask some questions. Toward the end of the show, we also have a pre-recorded clip relating to a rally that will be occurring on June 30th. Is that right, Spencer?
This coming Saturday. Yeah, this coming Saturday. Right.
And that's relating to the immigration issue, in particular the situation with the children being separated. So we'll play that toward the end of the show. Welcome, Micah.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let me start. We did talk about the case in Kansas. And I know we've had you on before, and there was another case at the state level. So if you could just briefly summarize the difference between those two cases and also what the new case is that you just filed.
Sure. So Kansas had, until last week, the nation's single most restrictive law on voter registration. The most restrictive law on voter registration, I would say, that has existed anywhere outside of Alabama in the year 1965, right? This is a voter registration law that made it very, very, very difficult for people who are eligible citizens to actually register and vote. It required them to produce a couple of particular pieces of paper, a birth certificate or a passport, in order to register to vote. Something that lots of folks who are eligible citizens don't have easy access to for a number of reasons. Sometimes because they've lost the birth certificate. Some folks who were older were born at a time when birth certificates were not always routinely issued. Sometimes they were students, away at university, and the birth certificate was at home in their parents' basement. All sorts of reasons that folks didn't have easy access to these documents. Tens of thousands of people in Kansas who are eligible citizens and trying to register didn't have access to these documents. This was a law that was passed in 2011 when Chris Kobach became Secretary of State in Kansas, and we sued about it starting in 2015. It's now the year 2018, so that tells you how quickly the wheels of justice move, right? And it's taken us 3 years to finally get a court ruling in this case, which was about striking down this particular requirement. The state case that you mentioned, Craig, was that Secretary Kobach earlier lost a different part of this federal case, the federal case in federal court about proof of citizenship and the documents. And the court handed down an injunction telling him that until the trial, you know, until this happened, he could not implement that law for federal registrants. People who used the federal voter registration form or who registered at the DMV didn't have to come up with all these extra pieces of paper, these extra barriers. When Secretary Kobach heard that, rather than accepting that, he said, fine, I will register those folks to vote covered by the injunction only in federal elections, not in state and local ones. And so we had to go to state court to stop him from pulling that nonsense, because that's a completely crazy theory. He didn't have the power to do it, is what the state court judge said. But that's what the state court case was. Secretary Kobach trying to do a runaround the rulings that had already come from the federal court, and so we had to go to state court to stop him from pulling that trick. Then you sort of fast forward to where we were last week, where on Monday evening at 4:50 or something in the afternoon, as we were all getting ready to pack up our things and go home at the ACLU office, we got this ruling from federal judge Julie Robinson, who was appointed to the bench by George W. Bush, was signed off on her nomination by Sam Brownback and Pat Roberts. That tells you something about the way our judicial system works, that there is still fairness and impartiality and objectivity at work here, because she issued this scathing ruling against this papers, please law, said that it was not only illegal under the Federal Voter Registration Act, National Voter Registration Act, but also unconstitutional as well, and forbade him, prevented him from implementing it in Kansas effective immediately. So now the short version of this is, no matter how you choose to register to vote in Kansas, whether you use the state form, the federal form, the online form, at the DMV, or through a voter registration drive, you can register the same way that people have been able to in the other 49 states all along, which is by signing the voter registration form showing that you are who you are, and not having to produce all this additional documentation that stopped at least 30,000 eligible citizens from registering in Kansas.
So is there anything that you would have to still produce to show your identity?
So we do still have a photo ID, voter photo ID law in Kansas. That is still on the books. So when you go to vote at the polls on election day, you still do have to produce a government-issued photo ID of some kind to prove your identity. Kansas has one of the more flexible voter ID laws in the country, so there are more types of documentation, more kinds of government-issued photo ID that you can produce than in many states. And frankly, the reason that law is a little less restrictive, a little less onerous than in some other places, is because our voter registration law was so awful and so restrictive that it didn't really matter, right? Secretary Kobach made it so hard for you to get on the voter registration rolls in the first place that he was willing to be a little less onerous and less burdensome on the voter ID side.
And if they're not required to produce a birth certificate, is there anything they would have to produce to at least show that they are a citizen?
So the voter registration form is a legal document that requires you to sign, under the penalty of perjury, a legal attestation that you are a citizen and eligible to vote. So when you sign the voter registration form, you are attesting to your identity, you're guaranteeing your identity that you are eligible. And if you sign it in error, right, if you sign it fraudulently, then you are committing a crime and you are you can be prosecuted for that. There aren't really any examples of people doing that. You know, we went through this long trial where Secretary Kobach really couldn't, I think he was able to identify one non-citizen who had registered to vote. All of the other handful of people he identified were folks who were eligible citizens, but wrongly voted in more than one place. And even those were a handful.
And not one of them, am I correct, would have been prevented by this documentary proof.
That's correct. That's correct.
Proof of citizenship. Except for the one who was actually a non-citizen.
And even that, I believe that one took place before the law would have gone into effect.
Okay.
In ACLU, they actually had, I'm sorry, Chris Kobach actually had an expert.
Well, I think Judge Robinson found pretty clearly that he wasn't nearly as expert as he claimed, or that Secretary Kobach claimed. I think most accounts of the trial, so Secretary Kobach did produce several people who he introduced as experts to make these just utterly false and wildly inflated claims about voter fraud. And the great thing about a trial is that when you do that, other people have the opportunity to ask questions and dig a little deeper and, bring up points in what you're saying in a way that you can't always do if someone is just out running their mouth on the stump or somewhere else.
I've been reading today Judge Robinson, 118 pages of analysis by Judge Robinson in this case. I'll put a link to where you can get that on our website and associated with this episode. It might be Thursday before I get to it, but I mean, this is so bad. I mean, it's like reading a comedy, except that you have all these supposed experts, like this guy from the Heritage Foundation, who Judge Robinson said, well, I can't.
I mean, she essentially said that they're not, that they don't qualify as experts at all, that the things they're saying
and,
are.
And worse than that, that he had been disingenuous, okay? He'd been honestly dishonest, right? Yeah. And he's like, and I don't know if this is the same guy or another one, but there was somebody who found nine records from nine different jurisdictions, and one of them had claimed that 3% of some population was potentially not eligible or whatever, and he cited that one, and he didn't cite the other eight that basically said, most of which said that it was absolutely zero.
Yeah. So my understanding is there was somewhere around 35,000 voters that were probably eligible and did not get to vote as a result of this.
So the actual number is probably much higher than that. At the time that the litigation, the discovery in the lawsuit ended, right, and we had to sort of all agree on what's the stopping point so that we can all agree on the same set of facts, that is roughly the number at that point. But that was in sort of mid to late 2016 that we were, before the 2016 elections, that we would have been using that number. So it's probably March of 2016. And of course, we all know that as you get closer to the election, that's when more people are actually going out and registering. And so the actual number of people impacted is probably even higher than that mid-30s number.
And you said Judge Robinson decided this based upon both statute and constitutional.
That's right. That's
right. So can you summarize what the basis of her decision on those two issues was?
Sure. So there's a law that was passed by Congress back in, I think it was 1991, early 1990s, the National Voter Registration Act, the so-called Motor Voter Law, which says that we want to make it simpler for citizens to participate in their democracy, that we want to reduce the barriers, because when we do that, we know that more citizens actually participate in democracy when you get rid of all the burdensome red tape, right? And so the motor voter law set it up so that when you go to do your normal transaction at the DMV to renew your license or apply for a driver's license, you can register to vote at the same time. And in Kansas, the vast majority of new voter registrations take place at the DMV. That National Voter Registration Law also spells out the things that you can ask about and the standards that you can set when you're doing that voter registration at the DMV. And one of them is very clearly not ask for this additional burdensome documentation that stops otherwise eligible people from registering. And so that's the sort of legal claim that Judge Robinson said, that this existing statute, this existing law passed by Congress back in the 1990s, clearly says you can't do at the DMV what Secretary Kobach wanted to do. That's the law, the statute. The constitutional claim is that you have a fundamental right to vote in this country. The right to vote is mentioned in the Constitution multiple times. In fact, it is the only constitutional right that is mentioned multiple times in the document. You know, the right to free speech is only mentioned one time in the First Amendment. The right to bear arms is only mentioned one time in the Second Amendment, right? The right to due process mentioned one time, but the right to vote is mentioned in multiple amendments to the Constitution. And so you have a fundamental right to vote that was being abridged by this particular requirement. You are stopping eligible citizens who have a right to vote under the Constitution from accessing that right, and that makes it unconstitutional.
And some of the plaintiffs had apparently dropped out, was found to be moot. What was the reason that those cases were found moot, and what was different about the two people in addition to League of Women Voters who stayed in?
Sure. So there were multiple plaintiffs in this case, multiple people who said that their rights were violated, that they were harmed by this horrible policy. We had a couple of individual people who were eligible citizens who tried to register but were stopped from doing so, who signed on way back when we were starting this in 2015. Right? And again, it's hard to believe it's been almost 3 years that we have been on this journey. And then we also have the League of Women Voters, which everyone knows does voter registration drives, works really hard to increase citizen participation in elections. And they were in the case because they had to completely change the way they did everything they did. They had to stop doing some things that they were doing in terms of a traditional voter registration drive and expend enormous resources, time, money, et cetera, trying to figure out ways to work within the law. And because they had to do all of that, they were a plaintiff in the case, too. A couple of the individual people who were affected either had their documents found for them by Secretary Kobach or someone else, and so got registered to vote over the course of the litigation, you know, before it came to the injunction, before it came to the trial. And so their claims for that reason were rendered moot. That means their issue had been taken care of. They no longer had a specific problem they needed to get solved through the court system. Some of the others did not have that happen to them, and so they stayed in. But everyone who was included in the case at the beginning was covered by the injunction and still got registered to vote. You know, even the couple of individual plaintiffs who were still in, who weren't moot because of the injunction, were temporarily registered under the injunction and are registered to vote today as a result.
All right. And so at this point, if people wondering if they can go register, they can do it through either the election office and can still go through the Motor Vehicles Department to register.
That's right. So unlike 2 weeks ago, where you went to register to vote made a difference in the process and what it would look like for you. Today, because of Judge Robinson's order, the process will be the same everywhere. So if you go to your county clerk, your county election office, if you use the online form that the state has available, if you use the federal voter registration form that you can get either in paper or online, no matter how you do it, all you have to do is complete the registration form, sign it, attest to living in Kansas. You do not have to produce all of these extra pieces of paper and extra documentation.
And then two other, unrelated to that, two other voting issues. One is, of course, Kansas does still have a fairly lengthy period where you have to register 20 days before the primary or 20 days before the general election. And they also have the law that if you move, you have to register in a new place. So if you're trapped in that 20 days, if you move during that 20 days, what should you do?
Sure. So one thing I would say is that we are trying to bring Election Day registration to Kansas to get rid of that long 20-day window and make it so that you can register and vote on the same day through the early voting period and up to and including Election Day itself. This is something that they have in 12 or 13 other states now. Everywhere they have tried it, it has resulted in an immediate increase in voter turnout, 11% and 12%. Increase in voter turnout that is sustained for years and years and years, right? If there is one thing you can do to actually encourage more people to participate in our elections to turn out and vote, the single best thing you can do for that is have Election Day registration. So we're trying to bring that to Kansas, which would address that 20-day window. The second thing is that they are supposed to update your registration if you move in that 20-day window. They are supposed to do that on their end. If you check the box on the form, they're supposed to handle it. As a practical matter, that doesn't always happen, especially in that 20-day window when the election office is getting pretty busy. So if you know that you are registered to vote and that you've moved and they are telling you at the polls or in the early voting period that they don't find you, you should ask for a provisional ballot. This is where you are still given a ballot, you still fill it out, and then you have a window after the election to work with the election authorities to show that you are, in fact, registered in that place and that your vote should be counted. But anytime you have any issues at the polls and like that, you should ask for a provisional ballot. That at least keeps the clock ticking to make sure that your vote counts.
So you, as long as you notify them of your new address, that registration is still valid
even
if you move in that 20 days.
So long as it's within the state, right? If you move across the state line, if you move from Kansas City, Missouri to Kansas City, Kansas, then no, that's not accurate. Right. But if you move within the state, whether it's from one county to another or just from one street to another within the county, if you update your registration with them, they're supposed to effectively transfer it from one place to the other.
And then there was a case in Ohio where the Supreme Court said that Ohio could purge people. They would purging people essentially who had not voted in 2 years to
right.
keep
this
it current.
This is a case that the ACLU itself was involved in participated in the case out of Ohio with the A. Philip Randolph Institute and some others that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was decided, I believe, last week. We are deeply troubled by the decision. We disagree with it vehemently. And we think that it means that we will all have to be much more mindful of state laws around purging of voters moving on. You should not be purged from the rolls. You should not be taken off from the rolls for not voting. You have a constitutional right to not vote as well as a constitutional right to vote. Deciding that none of the options available to you in that election are ones that you find attractive, and so you don't want to turn out and vote for any of those people, should not cause you to be deregistered, particularly not in such a narrow time.
Does Kansas have any similar law?
So not like Ohio, no. Okay. It is true that Kansas does go through the voter registration list and take people off that they believe are inactive, deceased, etc., but it is not in the way that they did in Ohio, which was essentially sending postcards to people, and if they did not respond to the postcard and did not vote in, I believe it was two consecutive cycles.
Is there a website that people can go to, like a couple months before the election, to check to make sure they're listed as still being registered?
Yes, so there is a voter registration website that the Secretary of State operates where people can check their status. But I always tell people, don't just do that. Call your county clerk or your county election officer, depending on what county
you
live in.
Or you can go on, in Johnson County, you can go on the Johnson County, I can't remember, it's Johnson County, JocoElections.org
or something like that.
And you can get a sample ballot. You can confirm that you're registered and get a sample ballot and so forth. I've done that one.
But always contact your local county election clerk or whatever directly rather than just sometimes.
The ACLU has a new suit against Kobach.
That's right. Last Tuesday we filed a lawsuit against Secretary Kobach. We won the big voting rights victory on Monday, which we had no idea what the timing on that was going to be, right? The judge decides when the judge decides. We have no idea. It was a total shock to us. We were planning to file the new litigation on Tuesday anyways. And so the timing just couldn't have been better in that sense. It sent all of us into a frenzy because we were all busy getting ready for Tuesday and then had to deal with stuff on Monday night in addition. But the lawsuit on Tuesday is that Secretary Kobach operates this program called CrossCheck, the CrossCheck system, which originally was designed by his predecessor as Secretary of State, Ron Thornburg, designed to identify places where people were registered in more than one state. And that's a perfectly fine thing to have and to do and a perfectly legitimate venture. Under Secretary Kobach's leadership, however, it has degenerated into a technologically obsolete, horribly ineffective, and ineptly managed program that has millions of people's information, and Secretary Kobach has managed it in the most reckless way imaginable. This particular case was about people, Secretary Kobach, sending people's social security numbers to Florida via unencrypted email from this big system he had. He found 945 people who had similar names to people in Florida. He decided they were the same people, even though they're actually not. And so he sent an email with a spreadsheet with their information in it in a way that left them really vulnerable to identity theft, to identity fraud. And so we sued him about protecting those people's privacy because you shouldn't have to have your Social Security number exposed to the whole wide world to be registered to vote in Kansas.
All right. So I want to thank you. For those just joining us, we've been talking to Micah Kubik from the ACLU, and we've been talking about voter issues. So next up is we're going to play a piece that Spencer pre-recorded with Ramon Valdez, is that right, on the immigration issue that we mentioned before.
This is Spencer Gray. I'm talking with Ramon Valdez. Ramon, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, the organization you represent?
Absolutely. So my name is Ramon Valdez. I work with a nonprofit called Innovation Law Lab. We've actually been working with the thousands of Central American asylum-seeking families that have been coming to the United States over the past 5 to 10 years while they're detained at a what we call a family detention center in South Texas, a small little town called Dilley. It holds 2,400 people. And so these are the families that were then starting, they started being separated from their children. Many of the families coming through that same humanitarian crisis in Central America. And so there's been a public outcry over this egregious and disgusting policy of taking infant children from their parents and keeping them in cages, sometimes in abandoned Walmarts, other times in these tent cities in South Texas. And so last week, there was an executive order signed by President Trump that's created a little bit of confusion. I think a lot of folks in our community are under the impression that the problem has been solved, and that's just not the case. Section 3 of that executive order says that the government will maintain custody of alien families during the pendency of their immigration proceedings. And so that's highly problematic. So these immigration proceedings take 1 to 2 to sometimes even 3 years. It's a long time that it takes. And so what we're advocating for, along with human rights lawyers and human rights advocates, is that there is no scenario in which children should be detained, not in cages, not in prisons, not in camps. And so what this executive order does and what the Trump administration is positioning themselves to do is to start keeping thousands of these families on military camps, on military bases, three in Texas, one in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so folks should stay angry. This is not an acceptable way to keep human beings within our society. And so we need to make sure that we nip this in the bud before it becomes an even bigger issue.
And so tell us about the events that are coming up.
Absolutely. The biggest event, so Move On, which is a national organization, is organizing a National Day of Action on June 30th, so that's Saturday. And so there's going to be a big rally in D.C. to protest and denounce this new policy and this new method of processing these very vulnerable people. And here in Kansas City, we're going to have a sister protest at Penn Valley Park on that day. And so folks that are interested can go on moveon.org, and that'll have more information. If you're an organization or a community organizer yourself and you'd like to get in touch with them, there's contact information on that page. So just go to moveon.org.
Thank you very much. Just a little background. A good portion of these are coming. What percent are coming from Central America?
I don't know the exact statistic, but I'd say over 95% is the vast majority.
Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, that's and right. Nicaragua. Just for a little background, the United States organized under CIA Director Alan Dulles, who was an attorney and had much influence with conflict of interest, may I say, with the United Fruit, organized a coup that overthrew the democratically elected Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1953. Che Guevara, the great revolutionary that people love and hate, was in Guatemala City working in public health at the time. And the coup convinced him that the United States would not permit democracy to break out in Latin America. And without that, Che would likely, in my judgment, have had a career as a leading activist, nonviolent politician, and MD in a democratic Latin America. So, in any case, Ramon tell us more about activities that are coming up?
And so, that's a really important piece of history to keep in mind, because that directly impacts and led to the creation of this humanitarian crisis.
So if you don't want those people coming here, stop providing guns to the agents of state terror in their countries of origin.
So the United States, as you mentioned, has been destabilizing that region of the country for a long period of time. We actually, as you mentioned, helped fund some of those death squads. My family's from El Salvador. My mom remembers and survived those civil wars. And so after that was going on, there was a first wave of refugee in the 1980s that came to the United States. Many of them ended up living in cities like Los Angeles, where I grew up, where the situation was very dangerous. They were targeted by criminal organizations like the Crips, the Bloods, the Mexican Mafia. So many formed their own gangs. Then the United States did a massive deportation of these gangs under the Bill Clinton administration. And so then the instability plus these criminal actors going to Central America, just everything just imploded. And it's gotten to the point where these gangs are the political social power. They have corrupted the police. There is nowhere to go. So when you're threatened, folks have to leave the country and seek safety on the continent, which is the United States.
Right. And while you're talking about that, it reminds me that Alfred W. McCoy has published a book years ago called The Politics of Heroin, and is his more recent edition basically says, the original and the more recent edition says that drug trafficking has been used since at least the Vietnam War to provide off the books funding for quote CIA assets in foreign countries. So in any case, you've got demonstration. We've got only 10 more seconds. So repeat what park is this? This coming Saturday, right?
This is Penn Valley Park on June 30th. We want the United States to respect asylum, and we want to treat these asylum seekers in a humane way.